Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Back from the dead. I understand I was dead last week. Is that what happened?
You think we all were, right?
No, that's I was told in no uncertain terms that that I died, and that's why I was not on the podcast last week.
We didn't have a podcast last week.
Really?
What about the week before that?
Yeah.
The week before that. Yeah, I remember, like, some friend of ours did something last week.
No, I don't remember that person, because the podcast has always been you and me and the fantastic Tom Merritt, host of Daily Technician.
Yeah, I didn't say there was somebody else who was a part of this podcast. I said that we had to go
that
to
would be
somebody
history, who wouldn't was it?
Yeah, doing yeah. something.
Got it. That makes sense now. I got it.
Weird. Berenstain Bear moment. Okay, moving right along. So that's Tom Merritt, you know, as usual, as is course, as is everything normal here. It's the only normal thing here on Weird Things is this lineup.
We've always been at war with East Asia, and Tom Merritt has always been the co-host of the Weird Things podcast.
Yeah.
Speaking of war.
I can't imagine doing it all this years without you.
Yeah. Speaking of war.
Yes.
On the Late Show, Colbert Late Show, still wrapping my head around that. Elon Musk declared war.
On Mars, right?
So, all right, guys, let me hear your opinion on this. Good idea or most awesome idea we've ever heard? Elon Musk, in order to terraform Mars, suggested, you know, hey, maybe what we need to do is just not drop some thermonuclear bombs on the ice caps. Speed things along.
There was, and by the way, from what I understand, that was like near the end of the interview. All of a sudden, he turns into the mad super genius that we all know he secretly is. He's literally building a spaceship fleet so he can take on Mars.
I love how he offhandedly said it, too. He's like, well, we could use nuclear bombs. I mean, that's in his arsenal. That's Elon Musk. He's like, well, I got all kinds of things. I could throw a comet at it. I could nuke it. Maybe we should nuke it.
I'm going to see if Neshcom can dig it up and throw it up on the diamondclub.tv second screen. But there was, in a Reddit thread, somebody mentioned, this is a known proposal that's been around for like 20 years. It is suggested that with as few as 4 thermonuclear bombs, you can create a not breathable, but a big enough atmosphere that it will create terraforming.
Big enough
basically.
Ass atmosphere works.
Big atmosphere.
So basically, if I remember the paper correctly, 4 nukes, 2 over each pole, is enough to vaporize all of that and sublimate all of that locked up CO2 on the poles. Because when you look at Mars and you see the frozen ice caps, that's all, some of it is water, but most of it is carbon dioxide. And so if you unleash all that, you get a thick atmosphere that causes a miniature greenhouse effect that theoretically could warm everything enough to up enough to where you have liquid water. They say, I would love to take a look at the paper because it, I want to say that like a third of the planet could be covered in water after just a couple of nukes and you just let it go runaway greenhouse.
Yeah, and that's the key effect there is that it's, you know, sometimes when you think about how long would it take to terraform Mars, you think like, well, how hard would it be to raise the temperature of it? And you think like, oh, you know, that becomes a big energy problem. But as you pointed out, in theory, you know, a few nukes might be enough to just start, you know, increase the moisture in the air. And the number one heat trapping gas there is that we have is water vapor in our own atmosphere. So more water vapor up there that starts trapping that. And CO2 obviously is, you know, the CO2 up there is fantastic for doing that and can be useful there. So that's a cool, I'm all for it.
Yeah, the abstract, thank you very much, Neshcom, for pulling this up. But the abstract of the paper says 4 100 kilogram fusion warheads launched from a Mars orbiter can throw into the air enough dust to cover Mars' south polar cap. So it's not just that the nuke vaporizes it, it's that it creates enough dust that it darkens all of that, because normally it reflects all of that heat, and so cause it to sublime through increased solar heating. The added atmospheric pressure would set off a runaway advection effect and partially terraform the planet. We have the warheads and the orbiters. We could start whenever we like. So
and, I mean, what a great disarmament move. Like, all right, we'll get rid of two nukes. Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, you get rid of two nukes. We'll terraform Mars together. What do you think?
Dude, I'm all for it. I mean, here's the thing. The only possible hiccup on all this is if there is currently living life on Mars. And I actually have flipped on this. I deeply, deeply hope there is no life on Mars. I hope
so. You can nuke it.
Well, no. I mean, because to be honest, if there's any life there, that means pretty much we're not going to ever go. We're not going to live there. We're not going to move there because it's too dangerous, too toxic. It could kill us, and we will destroy an indigenous species. And
speak for yourself.
Oh, really? Yeah, you wouldn't be worried about Mars Martian bugs?
I mean, I'm worried about it, but I'm not going to be like, well, not going to go because of that. I think that, you know, it comes down to, I think that's not the deal breaker. You know, I think we kind of have to expect that. There's the concern that, you know, when they asked other scientists, what did they think of this plan? And, you know, none of the scientists they asked, by the way, had their own space program. I'm just going to point that out. reactions were like, you know, maybe to like, well, no, it'd take a lot more. Why not steer an asteroid or whatever? Like, well, it's got to be more targeted. And it's not quite the thing that, yeah, I think that a lot of people were just their exposure to the idea was probably the limit length of the phone call. But, you know, one concern and a justifiable concern, though, is the idea if there is life on Mars and we start terraforming before we get a chance to document and see what's there, we may never, you know, have an accurate picture of what Mars is like presently.
You don't think that politically, the moment we find out that there's life on Mars, that politically it becomes, you know, just this hot potato that nobody wants to say, yeah, let's go ahead and push it out of the way and start making our own turf?
That doesn't stop us from doing things now.
Well, but also, you know, we have a stronger conservation movement than we did, 400 years ago as we were moving over.
I'm saying presently, you know, there are things where people are like, don't go there. Don't do this. You know, this ecosystem, we shouldn't violate it or whatever. And then some people say, well, yes, we weigh the benefits.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what would happen. I don't think it's possible to know what politically would happen because it's such a complicated issue and we've never grappled with it before. But personally, if we found out there was life on Mars, I don't think we shouldn't go there. But I think we should make sure that we, you know, we study it enough to know what it was, where it came from, learn as much about it as possible. And then, I mean, I'm assuming we're talking about non-sentient life, right? We're talking about local fauna and flora, in which case I don't think it's wrong to move in and you know, try to, you know, make our own space there.
Yeah, I just think it's
Brian, you're saying you think it won't happen because people will object. Do you think it's wrong?
No. I don't think it's wrong. I say screw it. I say we're the dominant species and we win. And this, just, as far as I'm concerned, you know, this is just some real estate that we already own that, you know, we got squatters over
there. Do we own Mars?
Yeah. We sure do as we drink from our Occupy Mars mugs. there is substantial.
Why would we need to occupy it if we already own it?
Well,
that's all I'm saying.
There is substantial scientific value to studying essentially an independently evolved organism, and I acknowledge that. But I'm with you guys. I would like very much to say, cool story, bro. You get that half the planet. And you know what? Actually, you get these reservations that we've carved out for you. The rest of it, we're just going to warm up and
well, and do it's what a we whole want. Different situation if it's sentient life versus just, you know, so far the indication is if there is any life, it's like algae and bacteria.
Lichen,
and,
you know.
Sure. But, and who knows? Like, there could be tremendous advances. And that's what I worry about is people saying, no, don't go terraform Mars. It's like the rainforest. It's more valuable than the rainforest because even though it's barren and wastes and it's only got these microbes, these are microbes that have evolved for millions and millions and millions of years in a completely independent format.
And that's why I'm saying you study and learn as much about them as possible so that if there is benefit to them, you can preserve them. Maybe you can put a part of original Mars under a dome.
You know,
and
this is the reason I bring up politically, because oftentimes political decisions, and this is the great part, is we're entering the age where politics will matter less and less, because when you're a madman with your own fleet of spaceships, the opinions of the local governments, and all of a sudden the United States becomes a local government, becomes increasingly less important to you as you
decide
to go. Well,
no, politics is just the interrelationship of powerful organizations. You just become one of those powerful organizations. It doesn't make politics go away.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we may say, you know what, let's not do it. I don't think the Russian or the Chinese are going to have the same viewpoint that we do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I agree. While we're on the topic of
the Indians or the Japanese.
Did you guys see the walkthrough? TJ, our friend over at SpaceX, sent us a link to the new inside views of the Dragon capsule. Did you see that? The crew module?
Oh, my gosh. So cool.
Yeah. Looks amazing. We'll see. We'll see if...
nice gray tones.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is we're seeing these little vignettes. Here we go. And Neshcom just put one on the second screen here. But we're seeing these little vignettes of the crew Dragon in orbit. You know what it's like.
This is Dragon. Falcon has placed us.
And it's amazing because obviously.
Space Mountain intro.
Yeah.
We see the same. Time to next Delta V is.
So they show you a bit of, you know, what it looks like from inside the crew module, from the point of view of one of the astronauts. Spacious. You got portals all around. You got a futuristic space console that is an actual
space console.
You have
to have special gloves to work with those touchscreens, though, I bet.
It's missing me, like, eating Skittles floating in the air.
And by the way, it seems a bit, I think it's interesting, when he looks out the window, you assume you're looking at Earth, but I think it's interesting that
they got a reddish tint.
It's a reddish tint, and they're over a very red desert, like, you know, who knows what that could be over there.
Oh, but there's a reflection of an earthy thing.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I also suspect it was no accident that it was a very red desert they were looking down upon.
Elon Musk says the crew capsule of the Dragon is designed to land on any hard body in the solar system.
Dude, that's amazing.
Brian's abs.
Mm. and that means that the hardest part is that you have to have your heat shielding because, you know, what burns you up in the atmosphere isn't the fact that there's atmosphere. It's the speed at which you go into the atmosphere. And if you're going to something really coming back from, let's say, Mars or going to Mars, you're going to be going there very, very ridiculously fast. And so, you know, you have to slow down and you transfer all that momentum into heat. And that's the challenge. But, you know,
Here's what's astonishing to me. Have you guys been watching the web videos that they've been making for The Martian? Not only just the theatrical and the
I know there were some
trailers.
Recent ones that I haven't seen those yet. Well, I've watched some of the ones that were out a while ago.
What's great is they have this savvy kind of postmodern, like if NASA was going to go to Mars with the Ares mission, they would have an extremely savvy viral marketing team that would do things like show the selection process. And in fact, the most recent video shows Matt Damon training. And there's a brief moment you could tell he's wearing Under Armour brand T-shirts or whatever, right? And it ostensibly is a promo from NASA about how they select astronauts who have the right stuff to go to Mars. And then it says Ares powered by Under Armour. So on the one hand, this is definitely a commercial for Under Armour co-sponsored with the folks making The Martian. But it ostensibly is a commercial between NASA and Under Armour, which seems to be exactly the kind of stuff that's going to happen in the future. And it looks shockingly close to the materials, this stuff right here. It's pretty great. Yeah, here we go. This, oh my gosh, look at that. Yeah, they got a whole YouTube channel for the Ares Live. This right here is you see Matt Damon working out. Scott, is that Morgan Freeman narrating it?
You'll have to make the decision to start the journey.
It's Freeman Light. It's not him.
You take a step and another. Each day, your journey will bring you closer to your dream.
So, and obviously, I don't think any of this shows up in the movie. This is a commercial from inside the movie universe.
But carry on, and one day.
And then the plug for Under Armour right there.
Does Watney give you a Peter Quill like vibe?
Yeah, I don't think I think that's just I'll say that. I don't know. Anyway, I just thought that was really interesting.
Well, gentlemen, back to the subject of Mars for a moment. I'm just going to close out by saying, you know, I nuke it, do whatever. There's nothing, you know, what's the worst going to happen? And totally different news. French scientists are considering reactivating a 30,000-year-old giant virus that was discovered in Siberia.
What could go wrong?
Ain't nothing going wrong with that.
Yeah, the virus known as Molyvirus sibiricum is the fourth kind of prehistoric virus unearthed overall, and the second one discovered by the research team. And it's apparently quite big. A giant virus has to be longer than a half micron, which is 0.00002 of an inch. By comparison, Molyvirus sibiricum clocks in at 0.6 microns. So it's kind of a big, giant thing.
So there was a...
Virus-wise.
Man, now I wish I could remember the details on it, but Radiolab, within the last month, had an episode where they were talking with a scientist about the nature of, you know, viruses forever were considered like, you know, virus had to be smaller than the organism it infects. So, you know, obviously viruses are really, really small. And there was this entire class of giant viruses that were being misidentified as bacterium that nobody really inspected. And they only realized that they're giant, giant viruses. And apparently the overall thesis was viruses used to be huge, but as they kind of, and I'm going to use air quotes as I say, figured out the trick of injecting themselves into the host to replicate themselves, that they evolved to get smaller and smaller and smaller. So that as a result, the older the virus is, the larger it tends to be. If I'm remembering correctly, I leave that all to the Radiolab folks. But
it's tempting to see a pattern there. All of our, you know, reptiles used to be bigger. Everything used to be, insects used to be bigger. Everything used to be bigger on Earth.
Well, and
until all we're left with was Texas.
We in general tend to think of things evolving as getting bigger and stronger and tougher than the other guy. But there's evolutionary pressures the other way as well.
Yeah, we have KT events keep knocking us back. We get back up again.
So do you worry about this kind of thing at all, Andrew? Do you feel like scientists know what they're doing? Go ahead and activate it. Couldn't be worse than the Ebola.
Statistically speaking, the chance of them activating a virus that could be potentially harmful to humans if it didn't come from a human host or whatever, you know, there are millions and millions of different kinds of viruses. You pick up, you know, a gallon of seawater and you look inside of there, you're going to find tons of viruses, you know, lots of them, you know, and 99.999 of them are going to have no effect on us whatsoever. So statistically speaking, some random thing they pull out of the permafrost that, you know, might have an effect on us, I'm totally unqualified to tell you. I would say that, you know, we hear virus like, oh, but yeah, like there's, you know, there are a lot of, it is what we don't know. Like you pointed out the size of things, prions are a whole different thing that we didn't realize existed. And now we go, well, that's kind of nasty and stuff. I think, you know, we have to be cautious to be sure. But I don't.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, which is the greater threat to humanity? The exact same virus temporarily locked up in some permafrost out in the open in the wild where, you know, a few sunny days can suddenly make it exposed and ready to infect whatever originally wanted to infect, or, you know, that same virus in a lab with, you know, clean room conditions and built-in protocols that have a long-running history of being proved effective. You know, it's like we keep smallpox around just in case.
Yeah, they found this, I guess, in like an ancient squirrel's nest.
Of course.
So, well, maybe it can infect mammals. So
maybe squirrels should be worried. But were squirrels smaller back then? How do you have a bigger virus in a squirrel? I don't know. That's interesting. I feel like a virus that old is not going to be able to compete. Viruses have to mutate rapidly to maintain their infective vectors. And an old virus just seems like it would be left behind and be made meat of by any immune system now.
There is the idea that at some point our immune system says we don't need to remember, you know, no point in trying to store how to do this, you know, protect yourself from this. I'm very, very ignorant on the subject entirely. So, I mean, all I know is there's a lot of different kind of viruses out there and most of them are just totally harmless to us, and I think they used an amoeba that came from, you know, what contact lens infections stem from, to revive it. So, you know, most of your viruses just affect amoebas. So we're not an amoeba, guys. We're fine.
And the headlines on these are always, you know, kind of implying that, like, crazy scientists have giant virus and they're just going to let it loose. And that's, I mean, yeah, mistakes can happen. But my guess is that the scientists working with this virus are working very hard to make sure that it is not let loose anywhere.
Yeah.
That would infect their experiment, much less infect people.
Well, and that's the problem with science reporting is that, and I wonder how much we contribute to it. I think we couch everything in a very sensible kind of way. And we, you know, we play the game, but I think at the end of the day, we admit that we're goofballs. But, you know, science reporting skews towards the sensational. I remember when the LHC, Large Hadron Collider, was going online, you know, the big thing was like, so anyway, there's an outside chance we'll create a black hole and end all of humanity. And then, you know, someone says in an offhanded comment, you know, statistically being virtually impossible, but still it's enough to, you know, I remember in the heady days of 1999 when the internet was still dial-up, that being all of the message that got to me is the world might end. Ah, the year two, Y2K, it's coming.
Canned food.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you a latest little fascination with me is I've been on a current book project. I've been researching ice ages and interglacial periods. And, you know, as we all know, we are still in an ice age. We're in an interglacial period where it gets warm. And the last, you know, the last warm period was like this?
The Holocene maximum?
Well, we had the Eemian. So the Holocene maximum was like at the highest point of when we had the most, you know, ice cover. So you had the Eemian was another warm period like we have now, which was when things they got present day temperatures, the glaciers retreated and water levels were higher, actually like 9 feet higher than they were now. From a geological point of view, that was a mere 120,000 years ago.
Yeah, which is nothing.
We had a 15,000 year window of which it was as warm as it is now. At that point in time, you had Homo sapiens. At that point, as far as we know, still in Africa. They didn't get out of Africa until like 40,000 years ago. You had Neanderthals here. You had Homo erectus, and you had Homo antecessor, I think this name is, you know, which is very, very human-like species all over Europe. And, you know, you think about the idea of how many little contingent things happen that if things were a little bit differently, like in Africa, there's a people called the San people, the Sand people, S-A-N, right? And it's a culture that goes back 40,000 years. It's a very, very old culture. And these people, what they find, they dig up tools that they used, and the tools they use now or up until quite recently were like just within the last century were the same ones they used 30 or 40,000 years ago.
Yeah, that it's almost as though, you know, to call it it was not a sentient decision almost to build these hand axes. It's just every hand axe got built the exact same way. It's just what you did. It's it no more than a bird building a nest is a sentient act of, I want to make myself a house. I want to make it a little bit bigger. Oh, I want a living room over here. They just, it's the same way beavers build a dam. It's just instinctual. They just do it over and over again.
So yeah, here we have a very modern, sense. You know, we have modern humans who've lived the same way for so long. And because environmentally it was good enough to stay there, it did not leave. When we talk about intelligent life and other things, it's important to think about that if things were slightly different, you know, if we had one isthmus that didn't get flooded or whatever, we would have stayed in the same environment, not have a reason to really adapt because we were doing good enough. You know, that you think about one stable culture for like 40,000 years that was in, because that region wasn't as affected by the glaciers as much. But then you think, you know, what could have happened 110,000 years ago, 120,000 years ago in Europe? You could have had, you know, we've pushed back because Göbekli Tepe, you know, that the monument there, we're pushing back agriculture from like 5 or 6,000 years ago to maybe 15,000 years ago, our attempts of that. You may have had attempts at that 115,000 years ago where people did this thing. And then boom, along comes the interglacial period ends and glaciers filled up and form and cover all those land masses that would have been nice places to be, getting rid of everything. And the only people who survived were hunter-gatherers eating meat.
So what does that mean?
I have a new paleo book out. That's what it's.
Okay, okay. That's where I'm headed towards. Go ahead.
It's just an interesting sort of thing to think how remarkably contingent it is that we're sitting here and, you know, electronically talk about these sort of things. We're just, you know, we don't know how many false starts we had before.
Right. Right. Well, and so here's one thing that it made me think of as you were talking about how, geologically speaking, we are all of humanity is a blip on the radar. And I'm fascinated, you know, we've grown up understanding that there's more to the electromagnetic magnetic spectrum than we see with our eyes, right? There's this small band of, you know, what we call color light. And we know that there's more to it. We understand that there are bugs who can see in ultraviolet and, you know, infrared and so on. But it really gives you pause when you think in terms of time. You know, picture a being for whom a year to us is a second for them. You know, they live for thousands and thousands of years. You know, for example, you know, if there is a self-contained being that can survive and have some form of consciousness as it flies through space, what must space look like to them? And recently there was a on Reddit, I saw this, this amazing time lapse of a tornado, a plasma tornado on the surface of Mars. This is a plume, a corona, coronal ejection. And if you look at it, there's no doubt in sped up form looking at it that's a tornado. There's a tornado on the sun, which is just astonishing and hypnotic. If you just type in tornado on the sun, you'll see it.
Mm-hmm.
I could watch that all day, but I had I found something else this week that I wanted to share with you guys.
Yes.
Let's play a little game.
Okay.
Called What Are We Looking At? All right. You want to go first, Tom? What are we looking at?
Some moldy leaves.
Moldy leaves. Andrew, you got a guess?
I mean, my first instinct is to go, man, that looks like, you know, the lower jaw and the upper jaw part of like of a skull or something like that that's trapped in the ground. But then part of me goes, man, that could be the surface of, you know, Mars, you know, with ice on it, false color, you know. I mean, it's an amazing example of...
Oh, see, now that I blew it up, I see the teeth.
Yeah, sure. Right? Yeah. So now you can see the teeth. What you are looking at, and now the significant thing is that you see a bunch of these roots all around it, right?
Right.
Here's what happened. Yes, a couple days ago on... this is a long time. This is like from 3 years ago. 3 years ago on Halloween.
Yeah, it's from Hurricane
Halloween.
Sandy. Okay.
So it's exactly what I thought it was.
Yeah. No, but significantly, Hurricane Sandy blew over a tree, uprooting the corpse, the skeleton of a man whose body dates all the way back to colonial times. And it's like, to me... What hit me was the visceralness of, like, there's the rib cage right there.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Can you imagine you have this lovely oak tree that you have a rope swing on, that your kids play on, you have fond memories of climbing on, and then doggone it, it gets ripped over and wrapped around, completely gnarled in the roots, as if it's clutching to it, as if its soul was... Going straight into it is the corpse of a skeleton.
Dude, it's a heart tree.
Colonial times.
Yeah, better yet, it's an apple tree that your entire family's been eating from generations.
Yeah, Tondagasa in the chat says, aw, he fed the tree.
Right, and all of those lovely stories about people who turn into trees, this is what it looks like.
Yeah, it's not pretty. Yeah, that's disturbing, and that's when you think about, you know, for this project I'm working on, a lot of it's, you know, it takes place in Europe and getting into the prehistory of that. And you realize that you know, I mentioned this before, like I have like some Neanderthal hand axes and stuff, which aren't that expensive because, you know, these guys were making them for, you know, 500,000 years, you know, that they were continuously producing these things. And you start looking at, it's fascinating when you look at, you'll hear, oh, you know, this, you know, well, here's what's cool about the rise of like the Mayans or whatever. And you look at like, you know, when did, you know, Mayans, when was the height of the Mayan civilization, right? And you realize that, you know, the Mayans were building their, you know, kind of a pseudo pyramids, kind of like, you know, like, you know, I don't know. The first Mayan city started in 750 BC. You know, you already had Greek philosophers and all that extrapolating on stuff and documenting things pretty well. And then, you know, not too long after, you know, you had the Egyptian empires were already kind of, you know, in their later years and whatnot. Point is you look at these things, it's so ancient, but then we find things that are 10,000 years old and things that might be 15,000 years old. And then the idea that we find little remnants of things that may be even further back.
Do you think that we're cursed to always have to just speculate, or do you think that that due to techniques and technology and I don't know, new theories, that we're going to get a – how clear a picture do you think we could possibly get of humanity more than 10,000 years ago? Do you think we'll ever really know, or do you think we'll it'll be like the Big Bang where it's like, well, we have models that suggest blank, blank, blank?
The biggest boon in recent times has been genetics, has been DNA. And we can a haploid group is basically when a mutation appears in a group, a random mutation, and then you can see, you can pretty much figure out when that happened, you can track how that mutation spread. That has been wonderful because all of a sudden we have ways to look at present day populations, and we can look and see where do they migrate from, where do they come from, and that's been able to sort so much of the myth from reality. But there's a great, you know, our friends who do OpenROV, they have a project on Kickstarter coming out tomorrow or this week, which is a brand new Trident, you know, underwater submersible robot, which if you start having, if you get hundreds of people taking to those places where they're now submerged, you know, will we find cool things? Maybe. And I've been, you know, you look at, like, there's a legendary city called Ys, which was supposed to have been submerged, you know, in Europe after, you know, the daughter of the king slept with the devil and gave him the key to unlock the gates that led in the ocean or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you got a slut shame like that? She could sleep with whoever she wants, devil or no devil.
It's basically a different version of like Sodom and Gomorrah. But, you know, you'd find out that, oh, yeah, no, like, you know, Dunwich in England. Oh, yeah. Half of that already actually sunk into the sea through erosion. That there was an entire medieval port built on top of a sandbank, you know, in the 14th century that then one big storm came through and wiped away. And you start finding a lot of these accounts, you know, during the Roman eras, the Scilly islands in the very tip of the British Isles were probably a solid landmass. You know, we find remnants of a farm there where there just wasn't enough land for a farm. And so this was within time, characters we talk about, Caesar and other people, that there was a very different geography there. So as far as, you know, finding this stuff out again, underwater archaeology will be a big boom. Being able to dig unintrusively or minimally intrusively in other places is going to be helpful. You know, Göbekli Tepe, that amazing site, which maybe dates back 15,000 years or more with stones that weigh 50 tons, we've only uncovered 5% of it. So I think that we will get a better picture than we have now. I think that we will get a better picture of the spread.
And as a matter of fact, it's funny you mentioned that, because using those techniques, those non-invasive, you know, ground radar kind of things, just the other day I saw
a
super Stonehenge 15 times bigger than the actual Stonehenge found 2 miles away. That's amazing. And
not an auditorium, but what did they call it? Like it was like an event space near Stonehenge.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So
that's why archaeologists were describing it as a place to like gather and do ceremonies and such.
Am I right in understanding that Stonehenge, when it was discovered within the last couple of centuries, did not have a single stone balanced on other stones, that all of our pictures of Stonehenge were created in the earlier 20th century?
I don't know. I don't remember hearing that.
Let me see if I can find that. Let's see, Stonehenge.
I mean, Stonehenge wasn't discovered. It's been known in England continuously for a long time.
Right, but the place.
It may have been known to have the stones erect and then they fell over and somebody put them back.
Here it is, yeah. How they rebuilt Stonehenge. So, I don't know if I'm looking at a reliable source or not.
Yeah.
But we're seeing what appears to be photos.
I mean, like, why not just rebuild the whole thing then?
Well, I think, it was right. Picture shows workers on the site in 1901 and a restoration which caused outrage at the time, but is rarely referred to in official guidebooks. So that for it means that Stonehenge, jewel in the crown of Britain's heritage industry, is not all it seems. Much of what the ancient site's millions of visitors see, in fact, dates back less than 50 years. And then there are photos of them setting rocks back on top to make it look more Stonehenge-y. From 1954.
Well, it all depends on how they went about it. Were they going on reliable drawings from people who said it was like this, and they're just restoring it and putting it back where it obviously fit, or did they just slap it on top and go, "We think it was like that"?
I'm going to assume that they did it responsibly. So this is 1954 reconstruction. There's another photo from, it says the 18th, July 1877, but I don't know.
The oldest detailed drawing of Stonehenge has turned up in a 15th century manuscript.
Right. So yeah, there have been persistent, you know, representations of it, but, yeah, interesting. Yep, here we go. Here's a photo of a contemporary newspaper depiction of the 1920 restoration. So apparently they've been rebuilding Stonehenge over and over and over again through the years, just kind of being stewards of like, well, that rock fell over. Let's put it back on top.
I think, like, listen, Stonehenge is kind of neat. It's interesting. And, you know, I've read some neat historical sort of novels that talk about that kind of thing. But, you know, compare that to... Göbekli Tepe, which is, you know, 10,000 years older than that and far more advanced, you know, far more ornate carvings, whatever. It's like, yeah, it's great that those hillbillies made that 10,000 years after.
Yeah.
You know, pull up, it's the G-O is in like Dunar or whatever, Göbekli Tepe. I'll Gmail you this.
First thing that came up, I wrote G-O-B and it said Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah, because one of your idiot friends searches for it too much. You go look at what they built there. 50-ton blocks, carved stuff, animals, three-dimensional animal representations, all this. You know, and it may have been, you know, the present site is 10,000 millennia BCE, so 12,000 years ago. Stonehenge is 4,500 years old. So, and then there are parts of this that they think are even older, like 15,000 years. So, you know, it is insane. It's absolutely crazy. You know, it makes Stonehenge look like a bunch of just drunken hillbillies went out there and piled some rocks on top of each other.
Which, let's face it, not too far off. I mean, that's that could be accurate.
And I'm talking about my people, too, understand.
Right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with drunken hillbillies going out and setting stones up for whatever reason. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, well, and what I love is the, I don't know, I love the fact that we still do nutty stuff like this, stuff that will hopefully last ages and ages. Do we know how long the shelf life on something like, say, Mount Rushmore is, or even a Statue of Liberty? How long is the Statue of Liberty going to hang for, you think?
That's a good question.
I've seen Planet of the Apes, so I assume it lasts.
I've seen this historical documentary, The Planet of the Apes.
Well, and, you know, so let's take Mount Rushmore, let's take Statue of Liberty as they are right now, okay? And let's just say that everybody on the planet just gets up and vanishes. What's going to happen? And they have, like, there's been, like, I think Discovery Channel or somebody did a really cool, like, Earth After or what after people, and they show what happens to this. And you're going to get, eventually, if following history as it's gone, happened before, our ice caps, everything's going to start to increase again. This interglacial will come to an end, and you look at the long history of the Earth, and you know it's warm now. It was warm before. Have these little bits of warm periods, but up in these latitudes that we enjoy, they don't stay that way. You're going to get these increasing, you know, ice caps. These things are going to encroach. The glaciers are going to go through there. All the parts like New York City, most of Europe, whatever, is going to get covered in ice. It's going to wear away this sort of stuff. And that's not going to be every place that we have these sort of monuments. But, you know, eventually it'll be ground under, you know. But places that don't have to face glaciers might be different.
We see. I guess Mount Rushmore would be in an interesting position because, as Sunglow is saying from a government website, Mount Rushmore is estimated to erode 1 inch every 10,000 years. I'm assuming that's absent giant glaciers rolling over it.
Sure.
I would imagine once we get to that, you're going to see some flattening real
quick. It's non-glacier erosion.
Yeah. Which, again, goes back to that looking at the solar tornado. It's like on a fast enough timeline, you know, rivers of ice just flowing super fast over stuff will destroy it.
When you get in other latitudes, you're going to get – what will happen is you'll have, let's say, carved stones and things like that that kind of last the longest. They're gonna lose their features. And, you know, we find mysterious rocks and stones now that maybe kind of look like they could have been the foot from the giant and lost, you know?
Yeah.
Have either of you read Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson?
I have. Have you read Seven Eves yet?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so not too spoilery, but one of, if you want to be 100% spoiled, maybe close your ears. One of the main plot points, premises of the book, is that the Earth gets annihilated by rocks hitting it, and humanity has to figure out how to survive because the surface is unlivable, which has happened previously in Earth's history. Is it possible that Earth had a, you know, prodigious scientific advancement and that got wiped out and we would have no record of it because it would just melt?
So you're talking about ancient advanced civilizations, yeah. Right? I mean,
I don't know that we ever had a period of long enough habitability back in
to get that far ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I brought up the Eemian before. So the Eemian age was a very much like this one, you know, got very, very warm, and you had hominid wise Neanderthals, Homo sapiens, various Homo erectus, you know, descendants, Denisovians, all of these. You had like 7 or 8 different intelligent tool users around and present there.
Middle Earth.
If somebody had built a Roman level civilization, you know, roads and cultivations, agriculture, armies, and all of that in Europe, I don't think that we would be aware that it existed today.
And you're talking about if we go back like 100,000 years.
Period, 115,000 years. I don't think we would be aware that it existed.
So let's say what we have right now, what would you say definitively you're certain would last 100,000 years? Of, let's say, 3 severe ice ages and 3 warming periods, and then humanity rises again. What do you think they'd run across?
That highways with concrete and rebar.
So, okay, you think those would survive all that time?
Well, they'll get broken up and busted, but you're going to find – you're going to find worked metal, and it could be very rusted and worked out, but inside that...
Well, and it's funny you should mention that in A Canticle for Leibowitz. That's one of the minor plot points, is that there are these people who hunt around for the special rocks that have valuable iron buried inside that was placed there by them before times.
Yeah.
And it's clear they're talking about rebar.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be because our civilization's so large now, we don't have any reason to ever think that we reach this many people. There's going to be so many fragments and stuff. But if you dial it back to, the habit we have too is we keep building things on top of each other. You know, we've looked underneath Roman forts and found older cities that they're like, great place, already got the stones, let's build it there. You know, you have churches in England, in Europe, that the stones that they used to make those churches were for pagan temples at one point. And that's, you know, the places that are good places to live. And but it's weird too, because there is this habit of, and we haven't quite, you take place at Mohenjo-Daro and then Göbekli, which is my favorite, they get covered over. For some reason, people come along and they just bury them.
I mean, do you think it's just like, well, this is poor real estate, let's cover it up and make it valuable real estate that we could build upon?
I think that it might be a sign that what happens is that these places tend to, as things are good and you have so much surplus energy and effort that you can start building a city or start to build something like that, you do that. But then as things collapse, if your agriculture there collapses, and you look at all the little mini, you know, problems we've had within our own climate in the last 10,000 years of cold periods, whatever, and crops failing and civilization essentially failing, it might be a thing where, like, let's bury this because this was led us to wickedness, or you know, or it could be conquerors come in there and say, well, you know, look what happens with ISIS when they go in there and they find these thousand-year-old artifacts.
That, like Palmyra, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's horrifying. So, I don't have an easy answer. I don't. That looks like a really cool link there. I can't wait to see what this is.
This London Hammer here. It says here, this is from Mech in the chat room. He says that sent us a Wikipedia article that says the London Hammer is a name given to a hammer made of iron and wood that was found in London, Texas in 1936. Part of the hammer is embedded in a limey rock concretion, leading it to be hailed in some quarters as an anomalous artifact. It is, if an obviously man-made tool is old enough to have been encased in rock, the argument goes, then conventional history is wrong. And unfortunately, it's not a very big photo.
First of all, insensitive to call a London hammer in a limey rock. But if it's limestone, it doesn't take that much to get embedded.
Well, and plus also, can't limestone dissolve and reform or whatever?
You know, it might be kind of a foundation for which we build many, many things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Concrete.
It should be easy to test the age of that hammer too, wouldn't you think?
Hang on, let me back up to the rest of the article and see what it says. But apparently it's hailed by...
Just its sources may not be reliable,
yeah.
It says.
Creationist Carl Ball referenced the hammer in the 1980s, using it as the basis of speculation of how the atmospheric quality of a plea, blah, 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 blah. The metal hammerhead is approximately 6 inches long, has a diameter of 1 inch, leading some to suggest that this hammer was not used for large projects, but rather for fine work or soft metal. The metal of the hammerhead has been confirmed to consist of 96.6% iron, some chlorine, and some sulfur. The hammerhead has not rusted since its discovery in the mid-1930s. Anomalous.
That happens when you put a layer of rust on top of something.
Yeah, right? It stops being – the oxygen stops being able to access it. Let's see. Other observers have noted that the hammer is stylistically consistent with typical American tools manufactured in the late 1800s. One possible explanation is that the highly soluble minerals in the ancient limestone, nailed it, may have formed a concretion around the object, a common process like that of a petrifying well, which often creates similar incrustations around fossils and other nuclei. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Somebody just dropped a hammer.
Yeah, exactly. J.R. Cole says, the stone is real and it looks impressive to someone unfamiliar with geological processes. How could a modern artifact be stuck in Ordovician rock? The answer is that concretion itself is not Ordovician.
The answer may surprise you.
You won't believe what happens next.
And that's... You know, there is all those sort of – there was like, you know, the Barry Fell books and all that. There was all these sort of very rather flimsy books describing things to try to make a case of I have a problem with the idea of there being these big, huge civilizations 5,000 or 6,000 years ago that were that level, or 10,000 years ago even, that were as massive as we described, because we would have – and we do find certain things there, like go lucky, but like – really, really Roman era stuff. I think you would find, you know, we can find from the Romans, we can find, you know, their lead mines or where they're processing lead. We can find the pollution in the ocean. We can find sedimentary tracks from where that came from. And so I think there probably was very, very big interconnected civilizations that, you know, you look at the mound people in the Americas, you know, we have these mounds all over the place, which are kind of cool, but I don't think they're riding around in chariots and stuff.
What about plastic? Doesn't plastic last longer?
Not as long as some fearmongers would have you believe.
I'm talking about that, but just archaeologically. Like if someone had developed plastic pre-Roman times,
exposed to the elements, because I know in, you know, even in just direct sunlight, it breaks down fairly quickly, geologically speaking.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, if we're talking tens of thousands of years, I don't think so. Thing's going to find it and eat it.
Dust, yeah.
But I mean, there would be, you know, at what level does it become more, you know, like I mentioned rebar. Once you're making steel and you're putting it inside of concrete and you're doing that, then that gets to be something. You find a fragment of something here, like
radioactive materials.
True, and that's that. But if you're assuming that we got to that level, I mean, I don't think we need to get to radioactive levels, you know, radiation before we find some things that would be left behind. But
sure,
if the Egyptians had built their pyramids, you know, they'd been around 100,000 years ago, and they built them in northern Europe, and the glaciers came through, we would find a very interesting smattering of rocks that we might find some sharp edges to. We'd be going,
You know, it's really interesting because you get this weird kind of countercultural desire to make humans in prehistory something other than what they most likely appear to be. And that goes for, let's just say on the intelligence side of things, we either want to make them crazy smart, indicating that they had advanced civilizations and that their hubris brought them down and then they got wiped off the planet of the Earth, or we want to insist that they're so dumb they couldn't possibly have figured certain things out on their own, and therefore aliens must have come down and taught them how to make pyramids. Or are you familiar with the Dogon people of Mali in West Africa? Do you know about this?
Yeah.
There's a tribe, and this is from a book that this guy Robert Temple wrote a while ago called The Serious Mystery, where his case for ancient astronomers was that the Dogon people – of Mali are they knew about Sirius B, a companion star in the Sirius system, And therefore, no way these backwoods tribal people could know that stuff. Right. And then when, in fact, it just boils down to, you know, that they're observant, they've got their own culture, and that they've been watching those stars for years.
At some point, they had a strong tradition of astronomy that observed Sirius B.
Yes, exactly. Right? Although it's, I think that the crux of the argument is that it can't be seen with the naked eye. Let me see.
Well,
the more fascinating ancient discoveries are the ones that show not that they were super smart or that they were super dumb, but that they came close or even surpassed later cultures somehow and then fell back. Because that seems to make sense to me, is that we advance and then we pull back, and then we advance and then we pull back. But we never fall far enough back that, you know, we fall all the way back. So it would make sense that you'll see kind of startling progress, but not super progress in the past.
And also, just on the James Oberg, who's had the pleasure of talking to a few times, he went in and pointed out that they were wrong about so many things.
Oh, they just happened to be right about it being a binary system.
Yeah, that there's evidence that they'd had conversations with other people about it. And it's a neat, if you want to go talk to a people, if you're a missionary or somebody else, what do you talk about? Like, oh, well, this is interesting.
As a matter of fact, here from a quote from Skeptical Inquirer in 1978, astronomer Ian Ridpath said, "The whole Dogon legend of Sirius and its companions is riddled with ambiguities, contradictions, and downright errors, at least if we try to interpret it literally." Ridpath stated that the information that the Dogons had probably gained from Europeans to some extent resembles the facts about Sirius. The presumed original Dogon knowledge of the star is very far from the facts. So, it's one of those things where it's like, if you believe that this tribe never had contact with anyone who had heard of a telescope, then sure, yeah, that would be amazing.
It's such a cool story.
And that's the secret of all great pseudosciences, is take something novel, remove just one piece of it. It is genuinely amazing that this tribe cares enough about Sirius to have legends of it having a twin and so on. And if you just remove that little part that they traded with Europeans, or that, people communicate over thousands of years, and that knowledge, stories progress or whatever. If you isolate that and say, no, that never happened, there's no evidence that they ever traded with anyone, all of a sudden you have what is a curiosity becomes a downright miracle, just at the flip of a coin.
And it's weird, too, because, how much we know of recent history. We talk about, the Vikings going to, let's say, Iceland, and the reports that there were already Irish monks living there, and there's a little bit of evidence to that, whatever. The fact that we don't even know for sure, were they there, were they not there, how far did they go, and a better appreciation of the fact that the Vikings had been to the Americas and actually did a lot more than we realized, and it's like, oh, these things change. All right, one more thing where we do picks, which is kind of like, if you want to talk about how crazy legends and things like that can start, are you familiar with the Vadoma people?
No.
Ever heard of the ostrich people?
No.
I've heard tell of ostrich people.
Google search on ostrich people.
Ostrich people.
Oh, why do I know ostrich people?
The Vadoma people just brought something up. Can I click on that?
Yep.
Vadoma is what you want to look at, and apparently they have fascinating feet.
Yeah. It's a tribe living in North Zimbabwe, and they have a very, very high incidence of a condition known as dactyly, which causes the middle three toes are absent and the two outer ones are turned in very large size. They have feet that look like ostrich feet.
So, and do they have
lobster claw syndrome?
Do they have any trouble walking on them?
Apparently they're quite ambulatory. It's not even really considered a defect there because they walk around and they're just as functional as anybody else.
And everyone they know has that same thing.
This is amazing because this is, of course, this is real life evolution in action. This is how you have this isolated population that this continues to happen. And in this environment, for all we know, this is a superior, more useful way to get around and could eventually evolve in that direction.
Possibly,
do they take people who are born with five toes and bind up their toes because they're disabled? Your toes are all separated.
I think that it's still a minority position where people have this condition there, but it's so common that it's just considered a, no big whoop. But yeah, it's an example. You think of a lot of the crazy stories you'd hear about ancient peoples and other things, that you just go, we would just discount, oh, they're there I was a traveler and I was in Africa and I saw people who had feet like birds. I'm like, all right, crazy story. Let's just count that one as not true.
Yeah, Neshcom points out in the chat, he gives a quote, I don't know where from. Some have theorized that the mutation may have adaptive benefits if it aids in tree climbing. It's more likely, however, that the defect remains prevalent because of a small genetic pool among the Vadoma. It is against tribal law for members to marry outside of the group. That's interesting. Yeah.
A little bit of reinforcement there.
But then tribal law could be a genetic adaptation to make sure that you keep getting the tree climbing feet.
Isn't that weird? How cultural, like it's the chicken and egg thing, right? It's
we forget that our cultural stuff is dictated by us. It's not, it doesn't come from outside. So it's dictated by the same genetic manipulations that are making us do anything.
That is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely look it up because I hesitate to call anyone a noun people. But I can understand why people would think of it as they definitely resemble ostrich feet.
Yeah, and it's not a nice term to call them that. But, yeah. It's the Vadoma. We'll call them the Vadoma.
Yeah. Hey, so for picks, I got a quick one here. It's always a crapshoot when somebody gives you something early and asks you to take a look at it and please talk about it. And it is an awesome delight when you get something early and it in every way surpasses your farthest hopes, dreams, and expectations. And that is exactly what happened to at least two members of this panel when the fine folks over at Sphero gave us an early, is he grabbing one?
Wait.
All of a sudden, Andrew.
No, I don't have it.
Oh, okay. The folks over at Sphero sent us early units of their BB-8 droid. It's a miniature version of the droid of the same name from the upcoming Star Wars movie. I don't know if you've heard of it, The Phantom Menace. And it's amazing. It over-delivered in every possible way. As a matter of fact, if you just search, Brian Brushwood BB-8, you'll be able to see like the 45-minute unboxing that we did. And there's several moments when it utterly surprised and delighted me with stuff. They went the extra mile in so many ways. The packaging is beautiful. It's fast. It's responsive. It comes fully charged. It makes sounds. It talks to you. It's got emotes that you can have it, say yes or no.
I don't know that it came fully charged, but it came charged enough.
Well, yeah. I mean, it works straight out of the box, basically.
Yeah.
You know. And the head stays on straight and can turn and look in different directions and zip forward. And then they put in this cute augmented reality holographic display.
That was the only part that disappointed me.
Oh, really?
Because I expected it to actually project onto the floor. I knew it wasn't going to really be a hologram, but I thought there might be some kind of projection.
Oh, system, but I assume you knew there was some hologram aspect to it.
Yeah.
Because I did not. That was just like
the fact that you have to look at it through your phone and then you see it. I was like, oh, it's not quite as good.
I did not know that was in there. I expected nothing more than a remote control ball droid.
Well, I just read it on the box. That's all.
You see, I didn't read that. I did like a 12-year-old at Christmas. I just opened it up and started pressing buttons. It's fantastic.
Let me ask you a question.
Huh?
Mm. I saw Tom's. It was cool. Watched it roll around on the floor. I love robots. Like, nobody loves robots more than me. Okay? Let me make that very clear. But I asked myself, like, 10 minutes later.
Well, it's it's like any remote control thing. I mean, you could say the same thing about a remote control car. It's like, you know.
Which I don't own.
Well, exactly. But I mean, it's, 10 minutes later, Tom and I are at Dragon Con having the world's first BB-8 cockfight.
BB-8 fight,
complete with money on the table. And one of them, and we can verify at Dragon Con, two BB-8s entered and only one left.
Yes, that's true. Literally true.
It's like any other remote control gizmo, and I think at $150, it's just the right price point. You get a real sense of quality about it. It seemed pretty tough. We were banging it around. It fell off the table a few times, and its head went rolling away. You just pop it back on. I think it's a fine gift for this upcoming holiday season, and it was a real treat to, not be in that awkward position of getting something early that you're like, I don't really like this, but instead just. I was blown away. Yeah. I thought it was great.
No, it looks neat. I mean, it looks really, really cool. I just I feel guilty when friends give me things like that because like I'll play with it for 10 minutes, then I'm like,
and I'm done.
That's a waste of money for me.
Sure, it's like, but it's amazing because because, you know, Spiro's been on our radar for a while and I've always watched the videos. I'm like, yeah, that looks cool. That looks cool. But for some reason, you know, you just staple a little bit of Star Wars character onto it.
Yeah, play some Star Wars music on the app.
Yeah.
I had, when I was a kid, there was a remote control ball called Orb, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun. That was kind of cool because it was like kind of like my own little gollywog magic trick. That was a fun sort of thing that I played with for a little bit. It was no BB-8, but... You know.
Anyway, that's my pick if and when cool. You find yourself an opportunity to get one.
Tom?
My pick really, honestly, should be KinoFlow replacement bulbs because that saved my life right before this show. The fact that I'd pre-ordered them before because my bulbs went out. But no, you know, I don't know. Did you guys pick Seven Eves before? Because I'm in the midst of it and I'm loving it.
I mentioned
you're
it. How far into it are you?
80% through.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you're past the... and I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the end of the second act is bleak.
Yeah.
Like that rough. Like the whole middle act, and traditionally that's when protagonists run into trouble. They run into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, the human race does. Well, I'm fascinated by it. It sometimes it gets a little bit as Neal Stephenson can, lost in its details where he shows off the research that he did. And so there are parts where I'm like, okay, this is interesting, but not moving my story forward as much as I would like. But those parts are always well worth it because, as I told Patrick Norton, instead of Chekhov's gun, Neal Stephenson does Stevenson's long description of the development of ammo.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, I know I'm going through this because this is going to be really important in an upcoming scene.
Chekhov's explanation of orbital mechanics.
Yeah. Exactly, right? So I feel like he couldn't have done this without doing the Baroque cycle and Anathem first, but it really shows like what a writer who continually pushes himself and tries to come up with new and interesting ways of telling stories can do. And it bears on a lot of the themes that we were talking about today about, you know, survival of humanity and technology and et cetera.
Yeah. If I can real quick throw a plug in, this should have been my pick, but the hardcover or the softcover print edition of Scam School Academy.
That's great, Brian. Why don't you go do that pick too?
Oh,
that's fantastic.
Oh wait, were you going to do that? Oh, good.
Get in as many picks as you need, Brian, because my pick doesn't matter.
I'm sorry.
Brian.
No, take what's your pick, Andrew Maine?
That's what I went to get when we said picks. But it's much better if you pick your own book, Brian. Much
no, I just forgot to plug it, and then but I didn't know if you were going to mention it.
You didn't have confidence in me.
No, I should have. I'm bad.
Your first reviewer on Amazon, by the way.
That's right. That's right. So what did you say?
I 1 star. No, it's fantastic. So those of you that don't know what we're talking about, obviously because you know you're probably listening to this on audio, I am holding a copy of Scam School Academy, the actual published book. And I'm going to admit, your cover's a little bit harder than my cover. I have a paperback, but this is kind of a...
It's a flexi-bound,
semi-hard cover back edition. It looks like a Brian's notebook from school, although it's like spelled correctly and we can understand things. And it is a wonderful collection of all sorts of great Scam School bits and stuff to pull on people, ranging from chess to cards and to other things. And they have accompanying it are QR codes... Which, if you want, and it makes sense, it really makes sense in the context of this book because if you're going to want to go through it over and over again, you take out your phone, you scan it, and you get an audio commentary from Brian. You get an episode if it appears in an episode. All this great information. It is a beautiful, beautiful book. Very well. You should be very proud of yourself, Brian.
Well, thank you.
Filled with so many cool little bits in there. And it can be purchased relatively inexpensively and signed, too, if you go to Scam Stuff.
Yeah,
right?
scamstuff.com. You could get it it's so funny because I knew that theoretically you'd be able to buy it in bookstores. And I make the comment like, go to your local bookstore. But then I started getting photos of people who went to their local bookstore and found it on the shelf. And then it hit me. I was like, whoa, it's a real book. Of course.
You got to tell them, yeah, better yet. Take a photo of it outside the bookstore with a receipt.
It's fine. But the big thing is, if you do buy it from scamstuff.com, we got the first 500 units that are signed and numbered on there. And I think we're down to like the last 100 or so. It's been a pretty busy weekend.
So it is currently the number 26 best-selling book in Magic right now.
What? That's awesome.
And can I tell you, there's only one review. Guys, get on that.
Yeah.
There's only one review by me. I think other people should go there and give.
I mean, unless you know, more reviews will just take away our 5-star rating. In which case, you know, let's not.
That's true. That. No,
we can just keep it 5 stars.
Here's a simple fact, folks. If you want to help Brian, and that's a big if, admittedly, if you want to help Brian, you want to help this book.
It's a personal decision.
The more he sells of this book with a traditional publisher, increases his leveraging potential bargaining position with other publishers and other book deals. Amazon sales matter. The more people who buy and more people who review it, if you start giving enough good reviews to something, it starts to have some mojo. It's like its own Google rank. There's its own page rank that applies to Amazon books based in part by reviews, how well it's reviewed, what else you purchase when you buy it. So support Brian. Buy a copy from Brian that's signed for yourself. Buy a copy from here. It's dirt cheap. If you have Amazon Prime, you can have this thing delivered to you like Tuesday. There's only 4 left in stock. Make them reorder it.
Oh, yeah. But, no, they definitely notice when they keep getting more and more reorder things.
Yeah,
it's pleasing to me to think back to hearing Brian talking about, like, hey, buy Cheats, Cons, Swindles, and Tricks at the end of the early scam schools, and to see this glorious, beautiful Scam School Academy book. It's amazing.
Right, guys. It's been
wonderful. So again, guys, seriously, get this book. And just look at the pretty pictures and tell Amazon how wonderful it is and give them 5 stars and rank it highly. Buy a lot of them. I mean, I don't care if, you know, you're trying to pay for your daughter's surgery. She's going to be really bored in the hospital and you'll have to entertain her. So.
All right.
So
awesome. Thank you very much, Andrew. That was
and I like my reviews, so I can always have the number one review on Brian's thing. And then I can go back and change it at some point if he displeases me.
Oh, that was great. Was it helpful to you? Yes, it totally was.
There, yeah, no, I love it. I'm going to be going through there looking. I'm like, oh, I need something fun or fun bit or whatever.
Well, and keep
collection.
In mind, your contribution is in there. A couple, I think the napkin one and the
thing we made up in front of you.
The vanishing sugar packet one is on there as well.
Fantastic. So there you go. I don't remember assigning any rights to this. Anyhow, gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.